Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, of the making of books, there is no end. How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Well, some of our local listeners have been congratulating me on JBL's 100th program. It really was exciting for me to look back over what was accomplished. I do think, though, those programs were even more interesting because of the sincere dedication of the 60-plus panel. Of course, the unexpected death of Robert Harmon was a sad note in our history, and it really did take me a while to find a replacement. But then Daryl Hope moved to the college at just the right time. So speaking of the 60-plus panel, they're back with me in the studio today, and we want to continue our discussion of George Orwell's dystopian horror classic, 1984. So welcome, Daryl.
Welcome. Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Yeah, it's been a while. And welcome, Deborah.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Yeah, well, if you notice, my wife's voice is up and cheery. Her cough is over. So she's back with us today. So since you're back, we're going to make you work first. So Mr. Hope and I have already given our overview of the book. So why don't you give us your overview of the book so you can like catch up with us?
Okay, well, thank you. Well, it is good to be back, and I am feeling much better. Thank you. This book was something I thought that I had read years ago, and when I started reading it, I realized I hadn't, and it was really disturbing. I just didn't realize it would be that disturbing when I started to read it. It is so well written and so descriptive, and you really get into it. The sensory words and descriptions are very, very vibrant, and it is a very disturbing book to read because of it, because it's easy to get into it, and you really feel for the main character, Winston Smith. And one of the things that I was thinking about as I was reading it and thinking about it later is what it would be like to live in a world where you had no privacy. We take privacy for granted. Even if you live in a house with lots of people or children, usually you can find a place to go away and be private. It may be difficult, but most people can find a place to be private. And in this society, there was no privacy. You couldn't, you had to be careful what you looked like on your description, your face, facial description, or not the word. You had to be careful what you were thinking, because it would show on your face and
it's your expression.
Your expression, yes.
There we go.
That's the word.
Maybe you're not back so well.
The expression, yes. So,
can I just interrupt you once
yes.
for a second? I think one of the things that we mentioned this before, but the thing that I think is the real talent here with George Orwell, whose real name was Eric Blair, which was really kind of boring name. George Orwell kind of sounds cooler to me. But anyway, he is such a good writer that he gets very visceral. He knows how to write short sentences, but he knows how to really draw you in. And I think that's what makes him a great writer. And I think he has that same talent that Charles Dickens had, where you actually felt you were right there, you know, in The Tale of Two Cities, or you feel like you're right there. You feel like you're sitting right in the room with Winston Smith. And the way he does that is bringing out the smells and the colors and the fact that he has this varicose ulcer on his ankle, you know, which is just the thought of it, it's itchy and he has to scratch it. But that makes the book seem real. It definitely does not make it seem like a fantasy land.
That's true. It's almost like it's like realism, like even in some of the painter shows a wormhole in the apple.
I like Caravaggio for that reason.
I know you do, yes.
we have a big Caravaggio painting in our kitchen.
Yes. With a big wormhole in
it. Big wormhole in the apple.
So that's true.
Yeah.
And I know as I was reading it, I kept feeling like I just wanted him to feel better. I wanted him to be happy. I wanted him to have some kind of release. And it was very frustrating to keep on reading and different things would happen. And you could really feel for him. But the idea of just not having privacy and not being able to even have your own private thoughts was just that would be a very hard way to live. And that was an interesting way to think about.
Well, I think what, if I could just key off this a little bit, is that I think there's that whole, you know, this is, we're actually, for all your listeners out there, we're just really at book one, you know, of the, you know, there's three books in the novel. So we're just really still back at book one. And I think that's where Orwell lays the groundwork, where he really gives you this horrible picture, you know, of everything's gray, everything's dingy, even the food doesn't look good. The food,
right.
You know, they really don't know what they're eating, you know, kind of thing. But one of the things he talks about, and if you have your Signet Classic, if we just go to page 63, and this totally fits right in with what Deborah is saying, is he's talking about who your worst enemy is. And this is the bottom of page 63. I'll start reading here for you. It says, "Your worst enemy," he reflected on, "was your own nervous system. At any moment, the tension inside you was liable to translate itself into some visible symptom. He thought of a man whom he had passed in the street a few weeks back, a quite ordinary-looking man, a party member, age 35 or 40, tallish and thin, carrying a briefcase. There were a few meters apart when the left side of the man's face suddenly contorted by a sort of spasm. It happened just again as they were passing one another. It was only a twitch, a quiver, rapid as the clicking of a camera shutter, but obviously habitual. He remembered thinking at the time, the poor devil is done for. And what was frightening was the action was quite possibly unconscious. The most deadly danger of all was talking in your sleep. There was no way of guarding against that. So as far as he could see, anyway," he said, he drew his breath and then went on writing in his journal. So if you're sleeping and the telescreen is right there in your room and you're talking in your sleep about how much you hate the party, right, you're done for. And so it is amazing that the idea of the telescreen, but I do think there is now a component in our society where it's really the same, and that's with this all these new gadgets like Alexa from that's from Amazon, and then Google has their version, and Siri is always on. And I even said something in my big travel back from Washington, D.C. a couple weeks ago. I said something, and Siri said, well, that wasn't very nice. So she was really, I mean, that phone was listening. And so I know people are getting more and more concerned about Alexa and all these things because they are turned on all the time. And it is interesting that even if you're in your home and you're talking about maybe products that you want to buy, like I love Irish steel cut oats. Well, if I go and get on my computer and look at Amazon, all the ads for Irish steel cut oats are going to show up.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Really, you know, what he's talking about here, this was 1948. Mm-hmm. It really is kind of happening in our society. Mm-hmm. So, but anyway, go ahead,
yeah,
Deborah.
Well, that is amazing. I know that's basically really what I want to talk about. Basically, that it's amazing that he was so forward thinking. Even television was really new at that time. But he talked about a television that would be two way like that. That would be promoting the propaganda all the time, and then at the same time listening, and watching. Mm-hmm. Watching your facial expressions
all the time. And then also, if you, I know we use IMAX here in our editorial department, and there's a camera that's always on, and there's a microphone that's always on, and they know they can be reversed.
Right.
They can be reversed for people looking at you. In fact, I just realized that as I was getting ready for the program today, I'm going to put a cover on my camera. I don't want them to see me, stand up and, you know, tuck in my shirt or whatever. Right. What are they watching? You know. So, yeah. But anyway, I think that really is true. And of course, my wife knows how much I love my privacy, and We have our nice, sweet little home, and we're off on an acre by ourselves, and, you know, so far no one bothers us, so that's really good.
It's true about privacy, because that is one thing that's taken away in this book. Mm-hmm. Privacy and individuality.
Yes.
There's no individuality either. Everyone becomes a yellow pencil. That's what everyone should become, mm-hmm. and that's what you almost have to become to be able to function in the society that's being created. Mm-hmm. So it's a really frightening look at a society where there is no privacy and there is no individuality.
Mm-hmm. Right. I think one of the things we want to remember about the book too is, again, it was written in 1948. Some I've seen on the internet they say 1949. But he really. Maybe we should say he was writing it in 1948, and that's when he just turned it around. He took the 48 and made it 84. But I do have this course that I've been studying for dystopian literature, because I have a few articles I have to write on it. And she said that the other thing about this book is really interesting, and this I think goes along with what Deborah was saying, is there's a certain urgency in the book as well. I mean, it does get into your emotions, and you're urgent. Right. And the thing is I think we can see these same things happening in society. Right. But he was able to communicate there's a sense of urgency to do something about it. And if you remember, in 48, we just had World War II was over. Right. There was the nuclear bomb. You know, there was these, you know, beginning of the rise of these, you know, other let's say British Empire, American countries were beginning to rise, and they're still rising today. And of course, America and Britain are, you know, the two bastions of personal freedom and privacy are falling. Mm. And so I just heard on the news right before it came over that you know, there's another election in Russia, and of course Putin is running, and another guy's running, and he had to turn in his statement of his income. And he said over the last 6 years, he only made $675,000, when they know for a fact he's worth at least $2 billion.
Oh, yeah. And I wonder who will win that election.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Yeah. It's like, who's going to win?
Yes.
But this is exactly what George Orwell was talking about in this book. And let maybe we could get into a few other things. Derry, do you have any other thing you want to add to what?
Well, one of the things that I think is very interesting is this. There's mention in the book about a reference to a revolution that occurred in 1925, and he talks about this revolution as being the turning point, where he says that I think he's questioning Winston. Someone's questioning Winston about it. Were things better before 1925 or better after 1925? And there was really a very large, in England at that time, a very large worker uprising that apparently had ramifications throughout the British Empire and really shook a lot of the countries in the British Empire, and was really one of the things that started this whole process of disintegration of the British Empire. And he sort of references that in the book as a turning point as to when things are referenced by the people in the book, the characters in the book, as to, well, after this time, were things better or were they worse? You know, so you're sort of seeing things happening when he was alive. You know, he'd obviously seen the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917. This now had occurred in 1925. There were lots of worker movements in countries in the 1920s. So there's a lot of background happening at this time that you can see why he was worried about what was happening in a democratic society, that it was going the way of dictatorships and the way of tyrannies. And this book, like you say, has an urgent warning in it almost.
It really does.
That if we don't stand up and stop this, that's where we're going to be. You know?
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting. Deborah and I were watching PBS last night, and there was a program on the American Gilded Age. It was talking about Andrew Carnegie and J.P. Morgan. And it's almost like here we know that a lot of the millennials, that's the people, you know, 20s to 30, you know, they really want socialism. Mm. They really want communism. They want everyone to be the same.
Right.
They don't want, you know, they're really against the billionaires. But this show was showing that, and again, there was this uprising because Andrew Carnegie wanted to break the power of the unions. Mm-hmm. And they wanted all these. This is in the Pittsburgh area. It was in Homestead, and I've never actually been in Homestead, but I'm very familiar with where it is. But he really felt that if you were an owner of land and you were an owner of a business, you had a right to profitability. And of course, you know, there is some socialism behind the unions, mm-hmm. and they wanted to keep, you know, kind of like keep salaries rising. Well, Carnegie saw that was affecting his profitability, so he broke the unions. And I mean, there was a big uprising, but then there was the stock market crash of what, 1894, which Deborah and I didn't even know even existed, and there were millions of people in the United States unemployed. And so they started this big march on Washington. This is in the late 1800s. This is before the big crash. And so I mean, people were really starving to death in this country. And so again, it was almost like here Britain was already suffering and going down. Well, America had just risen to this incredible power, and then it was already starting to fall apart. But here that there was one day where J.P. Morgan went to the president and he said, "If you don't do something about the economy, we're gonna the whole dollar is going to crash." He bailed out the country. He had enough contacts around the world that he actually built America's gold reserves back up overnight and saved America. But see, people don't like that anymore. You know, people don't want, you know, these very wealthy people to be able, but he literally bailed out America. So it's just fascinating.
History it is, yeah.
Yeah. But it kind of leads me into, you know, I like to talk about in the book anyway. You know, this really is a book about power, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. It is, very much. And, you know, he talks about the only hope that he could see was, this is, of course, the main character speaking, Winston, the only hope that he could see was really what he called the proles,
right.
Which I guess is just a short form for the proletariat.
Exactly,
which was
that's what it means.
The working class.
Working class,
so he saw the working class as being really the ones that were going to be the ones that would rise up against this kind of thought control mm-hmm. and fight against it.
Yeah.
Which is interesting when you sort of see that by some people they were viewed as the problem, you know, but he sort of views it the other way around.
Right. Well, I did want to talk about the proles, you know, because they were seen as stupid. Since you brought that up, let's go to page 70.
Okay.
Because I want you to see how, you know, and maybe we could get people out there that are maybe leaning towards socialism and communism to realize. So if you look at the whole idea of power, I think some of the things that he really talks about, you know, how do you get it? How do you maintain it? You know, how do you get power over the people? And then how do you, you know, you keep the power? Well, he certainly, you know, when we talk about this character, Sim, you know, he was really the guy that was into Newspeak and he was building the 11th dictionary of it and all that. So we know that Orwell really saw that you could control power by language.
Right.
And he knew that there were so many lies. I mean, Derry and Deborah and I talk about things, you know, in the background before we come into the studio. But here you have the Ministry of Truth, which is really the Ministry of Lies.
Right.
I mean,
yes.
But I think Orwell really believed that if you tell a lie long enough and continual enough, people are going to believe it.
Well, that's what Hitler said too.
And it's he probably
right.
knew he said that.
Yeah, right.
And so, but here on page 70, he's talking about the rebellion, and he did have this is this hope for the mm-hmm. proles, but the thing is, the proles were actually had the most freedom in that society.
Right.
The party members didn't.
Nope.
And, you know, it was the party members that were suffering. So if anybody out there is really wanting to get into communism and you really want to get into the party, I mean, you're going to suffer. I mean, someone like Putin doesn't suffer. He's a billionaire, you know. So, but anyway, on the bottom of page 70, he says that, he reflected, might almost have been a transcription. Well, maybe I better read that little paragraph above. He wrote this in his journal. You know, he's writing this illegal journal, and he says, until they become conscious, they will never rebel, and until after they have rebelled, they cannot become conscious. Mm-hmm. Now that's deep writing. Right. That's really good writing. Let's keep reading here. Let's go over. Well, here's what we're going to do. We're going to go to the bottom of page 70. I'm going to break into the middle of that last paragraph. It says, before the revolution, they had been hideously oppressed by the capitalists. They had been starved and flogged. Women had been forced to work in the coal mines. But then he has parentheses, women still did work in the coal mines, as a matter of fact. Children had been sold into the factories at age six. But simultaneously, true to principles of doublethink, the party taught that the proles were natural inferiors who must be kept in subjection like animals by the application of a few simple rules. In reality, very little was known about the proles. It was not necessary to know much. So long as they continued to work and breed, their other activities were without importance. Left to themselves, like cattle turned loose upon the plains of Argentina, they had reverted to a style of life that appeared to be natural to them, a sort of ancestral pattern. They were born, they grew up in the gutters, they went to work at 12, they passed through a brief blossoming period of beauty and sexual desire, they married at 20, then they were middle-aged at 30, they died for the most part at 60. Heavy physical work, the care of home and children, petty quarrels with neighbors, films, football, beer, and all above, gambling filled in the horizons of their minds. To keep them in control was not difficult. That sounds like America today.
Yeah, it does.
And, you know, we know that the Communist Party has tried to infiltrate in America. And, of course, we believe, you know, they've done it. They've been, you know, infiltrated into the government. And what do most Americans like to do? They like to watch football. Mm-hmm. They like to drink beer. They like to go to films. Right. You know, and as long as they have their pleasures, they're happy. But once those go away, oh, the society's in for big trouble.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, there's an unsettling element of prophecy in this book, you know.
Really, it's crazy.
Because a lot of the things that it talks about are things that we see today.
Yeah. Yeah, well, one thing I think is interesting that's brought out in the book is like it seems like Winston, who is now, we know he's not in the inner party. I mean, you don't find that out till later in the book, but he's definitely a party member. But it's like he suffers. I mean, he, of course, he's got his own physical problems, but he lives in a one-room apartment, and he's got the telescreen there. You know, his wife left him,
right?
Because, you know, of the way they prevent sex even in marriage in the party. So he even makes that sad statement in the book. Well, I think I'm still married. You know, Catherine left me, but I don't know if she's dead or alive. You know, kind of thing. And so that's another way the party controls the party. Mm-hmm. Is they control them, they control their sexuality.
Right. And I think his parents were even kidnapped and disappeared. So you've sort of got this element also. There's no family continuity at all because you become uprooted, people disappear, and there you are, and you're sort of by yourself. There's certainly loneliness about all of this because you can, those around you that you love can disappear at any point in time. And given no reason, and there you are.
Right. And I think even Russia did experiment with that one time where people had children, they took their children away and put them in nurseries. And if those children didn't get the right affection, they died anyway.
Yeah, right.
You know, and so I think that Russia finally woke up and said, well, we can't do this anymore. Mm-hmm. But that, everything, and Deborah, you can chime in here too, I think everything in the party, you've got to give everything to the state. You've got to be totally devoted to Big Brother. And that's the way communism works. And I'm sure this is the way it is. Even I don't care what Russia does today with Putin and how balanced. They try and make him look so Western.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I bet if you don't treat him like they had to treat Big Brother, well, you're going to end up in Siberia, right. Or as right. they say here, vaporized.
So.
Yes, but like they don't really have family unit. I mean, like the family unit is not promoted in terms, and their sexual relations is very much limited and controlled, and it's all because of their, like you said, everything, all the love needs to go to Big Brother, and all the love has to go to, there can't be any emotions. The only emotion is towards the party and towards Big Brother, but not to other people. You can't have emotions to other people. You can't have affection or relations. It's all the party or Big Brother.
And it's interesting when you look at the image that's painted of Big Brother. He is dark-haired with a dark mustache. And it's almost like a Hitler image.
Every
time I'd read it, it's like, it sounds like a Hitler image. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of on this big screen that everyone's seeing. You know.
Well, didn't Stalin have a big mustache too, didn't he?
He did. Yeah, he did.
Yeah.
Okay, well,
all these dictators seem to have a big mustache.
Guess what, Pam Panel? We're out of time already. So hold the thoughts. Again, sorry about that. We're going to have to move on. So for all you listeners out there, remember our next book in this series is the young adult fiction titled The Hunger Games. Now, this is so popular among young adults, and we've been asked specifically to cover this on the radio. But anyway, The Hunger Games is by Susan Collins, and we still have a few weeks on that. But it is available for you at Amazon, and it's about $77, maybe $8 for Prime members. Now, this book is so popular, and it's been, you cannot find it on ABE Books. And when people buy it, they keep it. So you might want to get that book and start reading that, and you still have a few weeks before we start talking about that book. So please write me any comments you may have to jbl@pcog.org. You can also follow JB on Twitter at JBLiterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. And remember, you can leave me a comment at Facebook. So until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.